Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And we're very lucky today for a couple of different reasons. First, instead of our usual one guest format, we have two guests. We have a friend of the show and past guest, MC Sangaila, who's the appellate practice group leader at Buckalter in Orange County, California. And we also have Judge John Owens from the Ninth Circuit. Before I make our introductions, just a little bit of housekeeping. MC is a California lawyer, but today we're going to admit her podcast vice and make her an honorary co-host of the show. So MC, Judge Owens, thank y'all so much for joining us. We're really glad to have you here.
Sure. Happy to be here.
We may be setting precedent here today, so, you know, let's be mindful.
That's right. Well, MC, I think a lot of our listeners probably know a little bit about you, but if you just kind of want to briefly introduce yourself, and then we'll let Judge Owens kind of talk a little bit more about his background.
Sure. Really briefly, as you mentioned, I'm the chair of the appellate practice at Buckalter, and I've focused on appellate law for over 25 years now. And I previously clerked on the Ninth Circuit as well as in the Central District of California. And I'm very passionate about growing the next generation of appellate lawyers and giving them opportunities, which we do at Buckalter through the Kaufman Appellate Fellow position, which tries to give folks opportunities for appellate practice who might not otherwise have them, and then to launch them into clerkships if that is what they're interested in doing.
You can tune to one of our past episodes. I think it's episode 50, where she discusses that fellowship program in more detail. Judge Owens, thank you for joining us. If you'll tell our listeners maybe a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I was born in the District of Columbia, but pretty much was in California from the ages of 3 all the way until now, with a brief detour in the late 90s to clerk in Washington, D.C. for Justice Ginsburg and work at the Justice Department there. Most of my career was spent as a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles and San Diego. I did end my lawyer career, that is, as a partner at Munger, Tolles & Olson. In terms of ties to Texas, I guess my best tie to Texas is that when I was in college, I worked for the Golden State Warriors. And when I worked for them in the early 90s, there was a young and very good assistant coach on the team by the name of Greg Popovich. I didn't know him well, but he was always very friendly. He's very different than the Greg Popovich you see now during the NBA broadcast where he doesn't want to talk to anybody. He was very friendly now. And it was pretty clear back then that he had a pretty good rapport with the players where he could be tough on the players, but they liked him. And that's always a tough balance to maintain as an NBA coach. Clearly he's been able to do it. So that's my one tie to Texas is the Greg Popovich connect.
That's very cool. I imagine there's probably not too many federal circuit judges that worked in the NBAA.
I can't think of any. Mylon Smith was a very good basketball player when he was in high school at the Ninth Circuit. I should add that I was a law clerk for Judge Wallace on the Ninth Circuit. I was nominated by President Obama in 2013, confirmed in 2014. So I've been on the job now 7.5 years. So not as long as Judge Wallace, who's been on the bench now 40 something years, Actually 50 now. I'm not the new guy I was when MC first appeared before me many years ago.
One of the things we like talking about on here is just judicial selection and the different approaches. Do you mind spending a couple of minutes just kind of talking about the nomination process?
Sure. So it was the 2013-2014 window. Very different than now. When I was nominated, you had to get 60 votes. And so I think that part of the reason why I was selected was because the Democrats thought I could get some Republican help. Because back then they did not have 60 votes. The Democrats, they had 54, something like that. So you needed to get help. And so I think when they nominated me, they were thinking, hey, this guy with his prosecution background, I never belonged to any advocacy group, ACS or Federalist Society. I never did any of that stuff. I just felt as a federal prosecutor, it was wrong for me to try to align with one philosophy or political group, because then they could say, oh, well, you're only prosecuting him because you're with this group. So I never did any of those things. And I think that actually was a plus because they needed to get to 60 votes. So when I was nominated, it was interesting. Everything was about, well, would certain senators be willing to listen to us? Because I was nominated to a strange slot. So here's the story behind my slot. And every judge has a story about their nomination, right? So I was nominated to a slot that had been open for something like 13 years.
Wow.
12 years. It was the what they call the Judge Trot slot. So Judge Trot, a legendary judge in the Ninth Circuit, belonged to the band The Highwaymen, who sang the song Michael Rowed the Boat Ashore, was a terrific prosecutor in Los Angeles. He was viewed as a California judge. When he was confirmed, he was in Washington, D.C. at the time working in the Reagan Justice Department, but he didn't return to California. For family reasons, he returned, or he actually went to Idaho. So then when it's time for him to retire, or go senior status, I should say, the Idaho senator said, well, we get to have a say in who's nominated here. And the California senator said, hey, wait a second. He's a California guy. Just because he moved to Idaho doesn't mean it's all of a sudden Idaho gets to pick. So there was this standoff between the Idaho senators and the California senators for many, many, many years. And it was never really ever resolved. So the slot sat empty. And over the years, there were people looked at to be put into that spot. There's a judge, Andrew Guilford, great district court judge in Orange County, California, who recently retired, actually. He was being considered once upon a time for that slot, didn't pan out. So it sat empty. And so now it's time they're looking at me, and they're looking at also Michelle Friedland, who's a Ninth Circuit judge now. They're looking at the two of us, and they just said, well, we're going to nominate Michelle Friedland to the open California slot, which was vacated by Judge Fisher. And John, great news. We're going to nominate you for the trot slot, which was the messed up slot. So I guess you could look at it one of two ways, right? You could say, well, now I've got a real fight because the Idaho senators are not going to be happy with that. And they were expressed on the record they were not happy with this. Or I could view it as an opportunity because, but for that slot being kind of messed up, my words, I don't think I ever would have been nominated because there was this political impasse. I had an opportunity that otherwise I probably would not have had, but I still had the challenge to get to 60 votes. And then there's the whole, you know, idea. Well, do you approach senators on the other side? Do you not approach senators on the other side? And the people in the White House are telling you one thing and people and the Senate are telling you something else. And it's interesting how many people who have gone through this process, Judge Kethledge on the Sixth Circuit, who was a law clerk at the court the same year I was, he had the same analysis, like, do I talk to people? Do I not talk to people? But then all of a sudden, the Democrats changed the rule. You didn't need 60 votes anymore. You only needed 50. So now all of a sudden, I went from a, well, I don't know if he's going to get confirmed, maybe, to a, yeah, he's getting confirmed. And I also think had they changed the rules before my nomination,
you wouldn't have gotten nominated.
I would not have been nominated. So it's just one of those rare times where the politics were at a certain point, certain time, and that's how I was able to get through.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
I would just say for the Texas folks, that debate over the trot slot was real and longstanding, and it seemed highly unlikely that California would win out in that regard, because otherwise there wouldn't be anyone sort of representing Idaho, and they all feel, you know, a little like a little stepchild to, you know, other states in the Ninth Circuit where there are a lot more judges. So it was real. It was a real issue. And so when Judge Owens is saying, yeah, I wasn't sure, Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was a reason nobody ever got nominated for that before, because no one was willing to go to the mat and, you know, actually stand up and say, no, we're going to nominate someone and we think this is a California slot. So yeah, it looked like a tough road until things turned there.
Well, that is an interesting turn of events, and it's nice for you that you got through it and now you're in Article 3. You have Article 3 status. I imagine there are no complaints at this point.
Oh, no, no, no. I have a very good job. Explain to my daughters that I don't have a boss. And so I really, yeah, I could be fired, but I have to do something really, really bad to be fired. And trying to explain to them that that's not how most jobs work. That's always a discussion in the house, that daddy's job is not like a normal job.
Yeah. In listening to that description that Judge Owens was giving, I was thinking, well, there's a really good lesson in there in terms of mindset too, right? You could see a problem as a problem, or you can see problem as an opportunity and try to do something with that. I think that's just an important thing to highlight for people, especially newer lawyers who might be listening.
And the other thing I'll say about the process was, I actually put in for the district court a few years before in San Diego. And when I did that, I was only like 37, 38 years old. And I didn't want to put in for it, but someone who worked for one of the senators said, you should. And I said, well, I'm never going to get picked. I'm 37, 38 years old. I'm not going to get nominated for the district court. And the guy said, you're right, you're not. And I said, well, then why am I putting in for this? And he said, because if you do well in the process, the interview process, the committee process, you're going to meet people. You're going to make impressions on people. And that's going to help you down the road.
Right.
You never know when, but it will. And that was some of the best advice I ever received, because I did not get picked for the district court. But a few years later, political winds are different. Times are different. There's a new person in the White House in charge of selecting judges, and they have a certain priority. All of a sudden, I had made a good impression before, just it wasn't a quite part fit, right? The part, you know, when I was, they needed a 7-8, and I was a 3/4, so it didn't quite fit. But the next time around, they needed a 3/4. And then all of a sudden, it worked. But it was only because I had made a good impression before. Had I come in cold for the Ninth Circuit and never gone through the process before, I wouldn't have got picked that time.
In your career, before going on the bench, did you do trial work, appellate work, a little bit of both?
Mostly trial work, but one of the nice things about being an AUSA in Southern and Central Districts in California is you do your own appeals. So I argued a number of appeals before the Ninth Circuit. My first argument was a huge loss for the government. It was the constitutionality of one of the early DNA collection statutes. You know, now DNA collection is very standard and it's a norm, and I think people view it as a good thing because it's accurate. You know, we want law enforcement to be accurate. But there was a time when certain groups did not want the collection of DNA at all. But they were afraid what the government would do with the information. And so I had a case. It came out of a supervised release revocation of all things, which is a pretty minor, in the scope of things, minor procedure in the federal system. But the guy refused to get a DNA take. And so I had to argue why it was constitutional for the government to require it. And a panel 2-1 said, no, the DNA collection statute was unconstitutional. Gosh. So for the entire Ninth Circuit, now think about this, the entire Ninth Circuit, 60 million people.
Wow.
All of a sudden, DNA collection under this federal statute was struck down. I had guys from the DA's office in Idaho calling me, Montana calling me, what have you done? Oh, man, that was rough. Judge Reinhart was on the panel, so I knew I was in it was going to be a tough road on that one. The Ninth Circuit came around in bank and actually upheld the statute. So ultimately, we prevailed. But, you know, for your very first argument before the Ninth Circuit to have DNA collection struck down for 60 million people, yeah, that wasn't the best foot forward.
I would say you got through it, Judge. It worked out okay for you.
It did.
You mentioned in bank, and before we kind of transition into oral arguments, this is a total inside baseball question. I'm just curious about how does it work at the Ninth Circuit with so many judges?
Well, look, this is a great question because unlike every other circuit, we do not do full and bank. So we have 29 active judges. We only pull 11 for actual in bank decisions. And one of them is a constant. One of them is the chief. So you really have to look at it as we pulled 10 of 28. That's really how it works. So the odds are for an in-bank, I will not be involved in it. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's actually a relatively low chance I'm going to be involved in it. It's basically 1 in 3 that I'm going to be called for an embank. There have been a lot of people who have argued that our embank process does not fully represent the court. And there have been all kinds of studies back and forth on this. You can have some statistical anomalies because you could have 6 members of the court decided a case for the entire Ninth Circuit because it could be a 6-5 decision. So statistically, that is possible. There was one time before I was on the court where they actually upped it to 15 judges on the court, but that apparently didn't really resolve the issue. Mm-hmm. So that's just one of those complications, I think, with having a circuit at this large. I will say people have talked about having like the super embank or the full embank of 29 judges. And we do have facilities to make that happen. We actually do have courtrooms that can hold that many judges. I have to say, it is tough to get a word in when there are 11. I cannot imagine getting a word in if there are 29.
It'd be like oral argument in the round, right? You could almost be surrounded by judges. And it's tough enough when you've got 9 on our Supreme Court here in Texas, but that would be something to see.
To be clear, though, about who votes to hear en banc, all of the active judges can vote for that, but then who ends up being on the en banc panel is much smaller.
Here's how that's decided, is that if a case is called en banc, all 29 judges, absent recusals, can vote. They then, if the case gets enough votes to go en banc, a majority, so usually it's 15, but if there were recusals, mm-hmm. it can be less than that. What they do is they actually have, it's like an old bingo deal. It's a wooden box, and they actually turn the box like a bingo caller, and they actually pull out names. And that's how, even in the modern age, that's how they do it. And there's actually a poll, they call it a poll or a draw. And it's has to be witnessed by a Ninth Circuit judge. And so when the in-bank message goes out, here's the panel, draw witnessed by some judge. And that draw is done in San Francisco. And one time I actually witnessed the draw. I happened to be there and they said, hey, do you want to do this? I said, sure. Because my chambers are in San Diego, California. But the court operations are in Pasadena, San Francisco, for example. And that's how they do it. So it's a little old school bingo, pull out the names, hear who's on it.
That just blows my mind. I'm not in federal court all that much. But once you've had en banc, I assume there's an opportunity for an en banc rehearing or reconsideration. Mm-hmm. Do the remaining judges get to vote on whether to take the matter up on rehearing or reconsideration after the en banc opinion?
Yes. And that, I don't think that's actually ever happened. I mean, certainly there have been calls to rehear the full en banc. That has certainly happened. But I don't think we've ever had, as far as I know, the full 29 judges in the room like we discussed. But yes, though there is a procedure, and people, they get their en banc decision, they say, we're not happy with it. We want a full hearing en banc. And then the whole court, active court, votes on that again. But that's very, very, very rare.
So there's a little check and balance on that potential 6-5 opinion coming out on banc. Then you've got this nuclear option that worse comes to worse. I'm still trying to get my mind around that, but maybe we should just move on.
Yeah.
I mean, also of interest is if the court, a majority decides not to rehear en banc, there seems to be a renewed vigor with regard to separate opinions and dissentals from denial of rehearing en banc. I think recently there was one that had multiple opinions in that regard. And that seems to be increasing, but maybe that I'm just noticing it more.
No, it certainly is increasing. So I looked at the statistics of about a month ago, and the number of cases actually going in bank over the last few years in the Ninth Circuit has remained fairly constant, not a huge uptick there. But the number of dissent from the refusal to go in bank, those are way, way, way up. And I think that the new additions to our court in the last couple of years have been very, very active in writing dissent saying, hey, Supreme Court, you should take a look at this case. So certainly there is a direct statistical correlation between the change in the court's composition and the uptick. No doubt about it. Now, why is that? Part of it, I think it's reasonable to assume we have some new members of the court and they have some things they want to say. I think a second factor is that when you first start on the Ninth Circuit, you start with no cases, none. It's not like in the district court. So federal district court, if you knew federal district court, your first few years are the worst years of your career. Because what happens is if you're new, the more experienced judges will dump all the cases they don't want right on your head. I mean, literally like picking up the lunchtime cafeteria high school trash can and dumping it on your head. That is what happens to you as a new district court judge. On the Ninth Circuit, that doesn't happen. Cases are not dumped on your head. So when you start the job, especially depending on when you start, your docket is very light. And if your docket is very light, you have more to do. If you have more time on your hands, maybe you're going to look at other people's work a little more closely. Maybe you're going to want to write separate things about what they're doing. It will be interesting to see 5 years from now if this collection of judges is still writing so actively in the in-bank process, or will the other work occupy more of their time? We'll have to see. I do think it's probably a little of both.
Yeah, and I think too, there's different approaches or personalities coming on the bench. Some people are a little more reticent to kind of see, you know, we'll just see how everything shakes out before they really become really publicly engaged in that way. But some of the newer folks, just personality-wise, on the Ninth Circuit appointments are, I would put in the not shy at all category. So that's also part of it, I think.
This is another kind of internal operating question, but in a circuit that's so large, do you hear cases from every state in your jurisdiction?
Yes. So my chambers are in San Diego, but I have a what we call a Western state dock. So we hear everything. So I could be assigned to the calendars in Seattle, Portland, Alaska, Hawaii, San Francisco, Pasadena, Phoenix, Las Vegas, any of those places. And when you hear cases in Portland, they tend to be cases from Oregon and Idaho and Montana. You're not going to hear an Arizona case in Portland. So there is some geographic restrictions based on that, but not based on where I go. I can go to any of those places. And I think one of the things I'm liking about the circuit is that we are expanding in this respect. We've had many cases from Arizona for many, many years, but we didn't have court in Arizona. So the people in Arizona would have to travel to California to have their cases heard. I never liked that. I never liked it. Like, why does Pasadena and San Francisco have a monopoly on these things? Well, that's changing. We are now hearing more and more cases in Arizona every year. We're now hearing cases yearly in Las Vegas. So these are things I like, because our circuit, I think our circuit should be represented as a circuit, not as courts in on the West Coast, because we're more than the West Coast in our circuit. So I've been happy to see that change. And I always like going to Phoenix, maybe not, you know, July calendar in Phoenix, you know, maybe not, but Phoenix is a huge city. Mm-hmm. It's a huge city, and they have the right to have their cases heard there just as much as anyone else. We've even heard some cases in San Diego, which used to never happen. But even in just San Diego, we have four active Ninth Circuit judges in San Diego now.
Wow.
And Judge Wallace, who's senior, would make it five. We actually have more active judges in San Diego than we do in San Francisco, if you can believe that. It's just, you know, because when people were nominated, I live down here, Judge Bumate's down here, Judge Lee's down here, Judge McEwen's down here. We don't have to be in any particular city. And so, you know, the demographics of the Ninth Circuit are changing. The Southwest, Arizona is growing like crazy. Nevada is growing like crazy. And so I just think those places need more representation in terms of where court is being held. I'm very happy about that.
I wanted to follow up on the courts. Well, at least continuing into next week's calendar, where argument is held is really just kind of in the cloud still.
It hadn't really internalized for me that 60 million people live in your circuit. So you're essentially deciding the law for about 20% of the nation.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's a big responsibility when you think about it. Like when I do presentations for elementary schools and we put up a map of the circuit and we talk about it, maybe you say 60 million. I mean, it's the population of the UK. I mean, that's what we have here. And in terms of, you know, the revenue generated by the Ninth Circuit, just in terms of, I don't mean by the court, but by the states and the court for the federal economy. I mean, it's massive when you consider the tech companies alone that are located in California. So, I mean, Texas is very similar. I mean, Texas sure. In your area of the country is where it's at. I've never done this math, but I imagine you could take a lot of the states in the South, add them all together, And they're nowhere close to the production in terms of economic impact that Texas has. So California and the Ninth Circuit is still. To MC's question about what does argument mean these days? That's a great question, because during the pandemic, we actually didn't close for business. We stayed open, but what staying open means is a little different than you might respect. We were not open like Walmart. We were open in the sense that we had arguments and we had a little bit of slippage the first month where COVID really caught on fire, March of 2020. But after that, we actually did not have a downtick at all in arguments. We did everything virtually, so everything by Zoom, much like we're doing this podcast today. We are soon going to be reopening for business the old-fashioned way. I think it's tough as an institution. I have to say it's tough as an institution to try to make plans, because plans that made a lot of sense in June of 2021, all of a sudden in July of 2021, you're kind of like, well, gosh, that seemed like such a good idea before. I can't say what the exact timetable is, but we have had judges back in the courtrooms to have arguments. Now, it's kind of weird because we go in the courtrooms, but the lawyers are appearing virtually. But we're really trying. We're really trying. And I think the one thing that really is going to be complicating it is if the kids are not back in school in the fall, and I have every reason to think they are, but if they're not back in school, it's just that makes things so complicated for everybody, that issue. So if the kids are back in school, it's going to be a lot easier. Now, are we going to require lawyers to wear masks while they argue? I don't think so. But, you know, the District of Hawaii, for example, is requiring people to, if you're not vaccinated, you have to wear a mask in the courtroom, in the courthouse. Either you're vaccinated or you wear a mask when you're walking around the building. And I could see courts doing similar things, because obviously I'm not a scientist, I'm not an epidemiologist, but this uptick of cases that we're seeing right now, more than an uptick, has us all worried, that because we don't want to go back to where we were before as an institution. We want to get back in court and do things. And so that's our hope. But boy, you know, you guys know as much as me, someone's going to watch this conversation in August of 2021 and thinking, wow, were they off? They were crazy to think they could go back into court. But that is our plan.
Did your court do remote oral arguments before that, or was it all new for the pandemic?
Sometimes we would, but not very frequently. So in the past, what would happen would be lawyers were expected to appear in person. Every once in a while, a lawyer would say, hey, look, this has come up. Can I appear remotely? And we would say, yeah, that's fine. But generally speaking, everyone appeared in person, absent some rare exceptions. We've had a couple judges. There's one judge, Judge Gould, who for health reasons cannot travel outside of Seattle. And so he would actually appear remotely. I'm sure, MC, you've probably had arguments before Judge Gould, where he appeared remotely. Yeah. But generally speaking, everyone, you know, the judges were there in person and the lawyers there in person. I will say a nice thing about our circuit is we were way ahead on the technology. And so we've been live streaming arguments longer than I've been on the court. And so the idea of jumping to a virtual world was, our IT people did a great job with it because they had a lot of experience with it. So it wasn't like, you know, some of these courts really didn't know what to do. I know in California, MC, they were still debating what platform to use. And like,
oh, yeah. I mean, there were telephonic arguments. Oh. I mean, that's how it was for most of them for many months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, telephonic arguments, that back very early in my career, I had one of those and it was awful.
Nobody likes them. No. The lawyers don't like them. The judges don't like them.
Mm-hmm. It was really bad. 2004. I remember it was late 2004. I had one. And not good. So I think we've done a very good job in the technology sense to make things move along smoothly.
Yes, I can say I had arguments early in the pandemic and everything was just very smooth and very well done. And yeah, the technology was just, everybody was ready for it. Ninth Circuit was quite ahead of its time in that regard.
What percentage of cases does your circuit hear in oral argument versus submission on the briefs?
There are two different ways you can define that question. We have thousands and thousands and thousands of cases filed every year, you know, 14, 15,000. I forget the statistics, but it's a lot. And there are two tracks for cases. One track for cases is cases are resolved by a panel of three judges. And basically in a short week, they hear a lot of cases presented by staff attorneys from the Ninth Circuit. None of those cases get oral argument unless they're what's called kicked. unless we get one and we say, you know what, I think this case deserves argument. So there's a large percentage of the cases in our court go that direction. Of the cases that are set for argument, which I think, Jody, really gets to your question, of those cases, I'd have to double check the statistics, but I'd say normally between 25% to 40% of cases are submitted on the brief. That's just a rough estimate. MCI, you know, you may have a different take on that, but it really depends on the panel. There are some judges, mm-hmm. like when I first started on the court, Judge Reinhart wanted argument in every single case.
Right.
Every single case would be argued. So you'd have 30 arguments in a week.
Wow.
Right. Right. Because it just takes one member of the panel who wants argument to have arguments.
And I will tell you, that is too many. 30 cases argued in a week. That is way too many. Now the composition of the court has changed. And I think you're seeing more and more judges open to submitting certain cases. So now I think we're seeing, you know, 15 to 20 arguments a week. 20 mm-hmm. is still a lot. I don't want to undersell that, but 30 is just too many. And as a judge, my law clerks have told me this. They say, Judge, you are much better when you have 2 to 3 cases a day as opposed to 6.
I'm sure. And
yeah.
How do you keep it straight?
I mean, well, and especially by the last day of the week. I mean, if you're on case 28, that is very tough. So it's like, you know, if you're a chef and you have to prepare 3 plates, you're going to do a better job than if you have to prepare 6. But there are judges who disagree with me on that. There are judges who still think everything should be argued. I happen to disagree. And we can talk about this today. I actually don't think oral argument is the most important thing. I think that the briefs and establishing a record below are much more important than what you tell me in 15 or 10 minutes. Now, oral argument is still important. And oral argument has changed my minds in cases. I have gone into a case thinking one way and oral argument changes it. But that is rare. That is rare. It's far more likely that when I come into oral argument, I basically have made up my mind. Obviously, I keep an open mind and I have questions, but a lot has happened before oral argument. And it's pretty tough to talk me out of it at the last minute. It can happen. I'm not saying never do oral argument. Of course, do oral argument. But to me, for lawyers, you can't save a bad brief or a bad record by being good on your feet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure you've had other people on this podcast tell you guys the same thing. And that's very true.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas, or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
This is actually kind of a nice segue into the topic that MC really approached us about when she suggested that we have you on the show. It had to do with oral argument, not specifically the mechanics of it, more to the use of technology. Mm-hmm. An oral argument. And from what I understand, Judge and MC, feel free to chime in and help lead the discussion here. You are quite the legal technologist when it comes to looking at materials on the bench, using an iPad and that sort of thing. And I wanted to also mention that this is important because this is one focus of our podcast, is how to use technology in law practice, specifically appeals, but we don't see it or don't hear about it very much from your side of the bench. And so it's very interesting to us to hear how you use it. We'd love to hear about it.
In some respects, I'm very old fashioned. In some respects, I'm very cutting edge. So how am I old fashioned? Right. So if we circulate an opinion in chambers, a number of chambers will use Microsoft Teams and SharePoint. And they'll have circulating opinion with the bubbles and the comment bubbles, and you can say yes or no and all that kind of comment stuff. Generally speaking, I don't do that. Sometimes law clerks will have a little bubble for me to read. I do the old fashioned mark it up. Like, I'll read it and I mark it up. But here's where the technology comes in. I almost never, and I mean never, mark up hard copy. Everything I mark up is on the iPad. I use Goodreader. Again, I'm not endorsing it. I'm a judge, but I use Goodreader. And I just review the opinion on my iPad and I mark it up as if it were pen and paper. in terms of argument, which is what I think you're really getting to, yes, I'm a very big believer in using the iPad. And there are different technologies used, I will say. On the Ninth Circuit, many of us use bookmark PDFs, where you have a table of contents on the first page. It has all the cases and all the various documents. You just simply click on the case and it jumps you right there. The Fifth Circuit judges, I was speaking to Judge Higginson out of New Orleans, and they have a different way of doing it. And he's a real technology guy as well. And he has a way, and I don't remember exactly how it worked, but his way actually looked pretty good. And it might be that they actually hyperlink directly out of the brief, which we don't do. They've been working on that capability. But the reason why I like doing that with the iPad is, you know, you sometimes see judges come in there and they have the gigantic stacks of paper, mm-hmm. right? I don't do that. I come into court with an iPad and that's it. Everything is on there. And the nice thing about having the iPad in the courtroom is that if the lawyer starts talking about some case that hasn't been cited, I have Westlaw on the iPad. So I can go directly to it. I also can message my law clerks, because they'll say, oh, da, 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 da. The lawyer gets up there and says some crazy thing. And I'll text the law clerk and say, what is that guy talking about? And they'll say, well, if you look at page 5 of his brief, he kind of makes the argument there, but now it's different. So in a sense, I can get immediate questions answered by the law clerks during the argument. So then I can come back with a question for the lawyers. It kind of reminds me when on the Supreme Court, for example, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was, in my mind, the smartest guy in the building, smartest person in the building when I was a law clerk there. And a lawyer would say something about a case and you'd see this puzzled look on his face. And he would motion over to one of the clerks, and they have these clerks that are actually at argument who will run and bring them books. He could tell he was confused. So he would do this and raise his finger and the clerk would come over and he passed the clerk a note and the clerk would come back with the case. And he would read the case and say, counsel, that's not what this case says. You are incorrect in your characterization of the Rock versus Arkansas case. And so I can effectively do that through the iPad. I don't have a runner behind me who can go pull books, but in a sense, I have the same capability with the iPad. So I feel I'm much more prepared that way with the iPad. It's certainly a lot easier to travel, right? Yeah. All I have is that. And what I've been doing recently is I have an old iPad and a much newer one. During COVID, I got a much newer one. It's the one I'm using right now for this broadcast, but I still have my old one. So what I've been doing is using the old one as what you'd think of like a traditional notebook at argument, which has all the case materials. And then I have the new one, which I can message with the law clerks, and then also Westlaw. I can look up cases very quickly. And that is really handy because lawyers all the time, you'll say, is there a case that says this? And they'll give you some citation and it's nowhere in the briefs. And in the past, you just kind of let it roll. And then afterwards you figure out, oh, that's not what it says. Now I can, right then, I can say, I just read this case, sir, and that's not what it says. Tell me where in the case it says. So I guess the moral of the story is that as my generation of judges becomes more and more comfortable with technology, as lawyers, you've got to be even better than you were before. Because in the past, you could kind of throw out some case citation and, you know, whatever. Maybe we look at it, maybe we don't. We certainly aren't going to be able to verify it right then. Now we can. We can do it right then. So you better be ready. And it's being live streamed, right? So your client is going to be able to see it live or on the YouTube playback. They're going to be able to see that you tried to float one past us and you were wrong. So that'll be ready is all I can say.
And they wonder why lawyers have to spend so much time preparing for oral argument. Mm-hmm. It's because, so to all you clients out there listening to this, this is why, because you just don't ever know what a judge is going to throw at you during an argument. And maybe you misread the case, maybe you didn't. Or maybe the court, in skimming the case rather quickly, missed the short paragraph mm-hmm. that made the point that you saw as the advocate. And so that does really speak to one, yeah, you better be careful as an advocate because the technology makes it that much easier for the court to call you on it. But secondly, being prepared in advance mm-hmm. and making sure that you're forthright with the court in your representations about what the record and the cases say, because the information is just that much more readily available to call you on it if you're stretching the facts a bit.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad you raised that, Todd, because I'll tell you, pet peeves. This goes directly to that. We just talked about how there are certain weeks where I used to have 30 cases in a week. There was nothing that made me more angry that on the last day of calendar, we have case 28, and I knew the facts or the issues in the case better than the lawyer did. That should never happen. I've got 30 cases this week. You've got one or maybe two before us this week. Two is rare. You have to be the most prepared on your case. It's your case, right? Not mine. And that means that when you're mooting for an oral argument, your moots have to be harder than anything we ask. I mean, think about it. You have to put yourself in a very tough position getting prepared for court. So court hopefully will be relatively easy, right? When you're getting ready for a boxing match, that 3-minute round, you spar 5-minute round to get yourself ready for 3-minute round. The same is true with getting ready for oral argument. So for clients out there, if your lawyers need time to prepare, they need the time. I mean, trust me, it is a legitimate expense because you have to be the most prepared. And we've seen that. I mean, I think I'm a fairly easygoing guy, but the times I've kind of gotten upset is when, you know, a lawyer will say, well, the district court said this. And I'll say, well, where did the district court say that? Well, I don't have the district court's order in front of me. Well, you're appealing that order. That's why we're here. We're here because you didn't like what the district court said. And now we're here and you don't even have the order in front of you. So there have been times when, and this actually one time, it was an advocate on behalf of the state of California, where she was making some argument saying, you have to affirm because of this. And I said, where is that? She goes, well, I don't have it in front of me. And we actually literally gave her a copy. They said, Judge Fletcher said, here, have my copy.
Wow.
And, you know, you can't do that kind of stuff. Be prepared for oral argument. You have to be the most prepared in your case. If you're the second most prepared, that means you're already at a deficit. You're giving up 14 points. Use a sports analogy, right? You know, we're starting the game and you're down 14 to nothing. Don't do that.
That raises a question. What do you want to see from an advocate if you kind of stump them with a question? One that they don't have, it's not in front of them, they're just not sure about. What's the good answer for that?
So the good answer is to be honest that you don't know and that you will get back to us. And there are different ways you can get back to us. For example, if you are the appellant and you've saved time for rebuttal, I am totally fine with you saying, I'm not sure exactly the answer to that question, but when my opposing counsel is arguing, I'll figure out that answer and in rebuttal, I'll get back to you. That is perfectly fine. Or to simply say, Your Honor, I'm not sure yet. I'm running out of time. What I'll do, though, is I will submit what we call a 28J letter on the federal side, which is supplemental authority. We'll submit a 28J letter to answer that question. I have no problem with that. Look, it's best to know the answer, but there are going to be times where we're going to ask a kind of wacky question that you're not prepared for. And just acknowledge you're not prepared. What you don't want to do is guess or make something up, because we will figure that out. And that is not good. Not good. So just be straight. Look, the advocates I always appreciate who are prepared and straightforward. Those are the ones. And I'm sure you guys heard this a million times, that actually answer the question we ask. Not the question they want us to ask, the question that we ask. And there's a difference.
In the digital age, it's really scary. You can make an honest mistake in an oral argument, I suppose, or you can not anticipate the one question that you get stumped on. But if you go so far as to say something that's not completely honest or forthright, not only are you losing credibility with the panel or worse yet, the en banc court, but it's captured for posterity. Either in the Fifth Circuit, you've got audio recordings that are released publicly, but I guess there was at least for a time, maybe it's ongoing, Judge. In the Ninth Circuit, you have, I think you mentioned YouTube as another possibility.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the last thing you want is an opposing party or someone who, you know, has something negative to say about you circulating a video clip of you being captured on video, being dishonest with the court.
Oh yeah. Every argument we make is archived on YouTube. Every argument we held. So you can go back and see, like, if you want to see how MC does, if MC's clients, MC's pitching a client, right? MC's like, I have a lot of experience with the Ninth Circuit. They can go and watch every single one she's done since like 2011 or 2012, a long time. So yeah, you better be prepared. Absolutely. You better be prepared.
Well, what I want to know now though, is has MC experienced this from counsel table? I assume it was opposing counsel that would have been called out in this way. by Judge Owens or someone equally capable. Looking up the Westlaw case, you know firsthand, MC, because you brought this to us, that Judge Owen uses this technology from the bench. So from your perspective, what does that look like? How has that impacted your oral argument?
He's so fast. He's like so on top of it. Sometimes he's faster than the advocates in finding the page number for a record site. From the advocate perspective, it's beneficial because you're getting an immediate response, right? I mean, it's not beneficial if you gave the wrong page number or you misrepresented something. That's painful on the spot. But it is helpful to have like real feedback, you know, right? He's going to be looking at that paragraph or whatever you're talking about in the record or in the case. And then you can actually have a dialogue about it then, instead of the judges going back and talking about it amongst themselves and maybe not, I don't know, just not engaging. I always feel like we want to have the opportunity to engage with the judges who are deciding the case. And if there's an issue that comes to mind, you want to be able to respond to it at the time. And this way it's real time. It can be daunting, but it's also helpful in that way, because if there is some discrepancy or some question that you want to talk about, say, well, no, actually in this context, it means this. You can have that discussion then. I also say he is so fast at finding things. That iPad is like amazing. Plus there's like the lifeline to the law clerks, I guess. But a couple times he's like, oh yes, right. You know, Ms. Singali, yes, it's here. And hey, I found the page even before I'm looking down, looking for it. So I'm grateful for that. He's so fast.
I want to add to what MC said is that as an advocate, you certainly want your input, your arguments made before we sit down for conference. Because so we conference every day after the case is argued. Look, if you don't have a choice, send us a 28J letter and obviously we'll consider it. But just if you think about the decision process, it's much easier to influence us before we have sat down, the three judges with no one else, to talk about a case. And the notes for that day are written up by the presiding judge, as opposed to after that, when we come to some sort of agreement between the three judges, the notes are circulated. And then a week later, some letter shows up and says, oh, remember the argument last week? Remember I said this? Well, actually it's that. Look, if you got to send it, you got to send it. Like I was saying, that you can do that, but it is always better to get that in before rather than later. It's just the way, you know, the way decisions are made. I'm sure the political scientists have studied this. It's better to get it in before than after.
And so if you're technologically proficient as an advocate, hopefully you've prepared your argument properly. But if the court, let's say your opposing counsel is the one getting called out, you can instantly, if you've got Westlaw on your iPad, and the question, if there's something to add to the court's questioning or analysis, it seems like that would be a good opportunity. Yes, it's real time. And that is really daunting, MC, because most of us have gone in with our pre-programmed outline in our head. You know, we know what questions we can anticipate reasonably, but there's always going to be something that's going to be a surprise. And having to flesh out and maybe distinguish a case that the court has called out and questioned opposing counsel about, that really does speak to the advantage of having that kind of technology at counsel table with you as well, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's much more helpful than the big binders can be looking for things, but sometimes that's how I visually remember where things are. That I'm like, oh, it's in the middle of page, you know, this page, and I can find it better that way than through the iPad. But I don't know. I've noticed from doing the remote arguments, from doing the Zoom arguments, is that so much more is seen on those, that how you use notes and how you use extra materials is very different. Even not having someone next to you passing a note, if there's something going on when you're waiting for rebuttal, saying, hey, look at page whatever of the record, you really have to be much more self-sufficient. That the person can't be on camera on Zoom with Ninth Circuit as well. I don't know if you, Todd and Jody, have had similar experiences with the remote arguments, but it's really impacted how I do argument and how much really has to be sort of really in my head and much less, you know, looking at anything, whether it's an iPad or a piece of paper.
Either of you, I know Judge Owens, you don't want to recommend anything, but do you have apps that you find particularly helpful during oral argument?
I'm not going to endorse anything, but the reader I use is GoodReader, and that's the reader that the court gave me. GoodReader is a program that is useful for briefs and so forth. It's not a researching tool. Mm-hmm. It's more like organizational. When I look up Westlaw, stuff, I do not use the Westlaw app. I just go straight to the internet version of it. That's the version I'm the most familiar with. I mean, I actually am an older school Westlaw guy. I used to know all the little abbreviations you would type in, Focus and, you know, all these, I guess Focus might've been Alexa's term, but all these little things you could do. I'm actually much more of a fan of that. And I saw, I actually will still use some of that, those terms, like to find things, cases, I'll look for this word within 25 of this same paragraph as that. I tend to still find that's actually more accurate than the Westlaw algorithm, but that's primarily what I use, is really just those two, and they're fast. And I think they're very useful.
I'll chime in on that issue too. Goodreader is a very well-known reading app. You can mark up and highlight text in.
Yeah.
I use PDF Expert. I'm an iPad Pro user, Judge, and I use it. I've used it at the lectern and argument, but PDF Expert is an equally good product. Some people, myself included, actually prefer it a little bit, although I think it's just really a matter of taste and choice. I don't think one is, you know, so far superior to the other either way. I like it in part because I'm a Mac user, except for when I joined a firm that made me get a PC. Because if you're logged into the same Wi-Fi network and you've got a Mac and your iPad right next to it, then you can instantly load documents and move documents between the different screens. And so that was always a plus for me before, maybe less so now. But I'll just give my chime in there for PDF Expert. For anybody who hasn't really experimented with using the iPad in this way, I think it's another one worth checking out.
Yeah, it's probably way more old school, but I just use the app that's been around forever, that iAnnotate app, to annotate the PDFs and send them off. So.
Sometimes old school is good.
Oh, sorry. Do you have real-time access to the record on your iPad when you're up there?
Yes. That's one of the great things about the bench books, is that the law clerks pull out really everything from the excerpts of record that should be relevant. Now, there are always surprises, right? There are always going to be times where the parties reference something that really wasn't highlighted in the brief. In that case, it is difficult for me to access the district court record from the iPad, from the bench, but the law clerks can then email me those. So the answer is yes. Hopefully it's in the bench book that we discussed. The bench book has the briefs, the cases, the memos, and then the relevant parts of the record, but if something's missing, there is a way to get it. So that's very, very helpful. I also usually have, in the Ninth Circuit, we file excerpts of record, you know, so it's not everything, but they're pretty big. I have, those are on my iPad as well. So I have the bench book, which is like the focused materials, but then I also have all of the excerpts of record on there as well. Now, I will say this about iPads. If you have to find a particular page, if the documents are OCR searchable, iPad is great. If they're not OCR'd, trying to find page 900 on an iPad is not great. And that's where paper is better. So I want to, you know, I'm a big believer in the iPad, but there are certain limitations. Now, again, if the documents are searchable, then I'm at a huge advantage, because I can just type in the word and I go directly to that page. That's why the iPad is great. I think what MC is referencing is when times when someone will say, well, the district court said this, and they'll use a certain word. And I'll say, you sure they use that word? They say, yes. And I'll say, well, I just searched the entire document and that word never appears. So can you show me what page it appears on? And they'll say, well, the district court didn't actually use that word. They actually use this other word. I say, okay, well, you said, I just want to make sure. So that's where the iPad can really hold the lawyers accountable for what they say. Can I get to the point the MC was making, that you really got to be precise in what you say? Because especially with an abuse of discretion review or a clear error review, words really matter. And that's where the iPad helps us to really focus on what the district court said.
And to be clear, most of the judges on the Ninth Circuit, whether they use them as actively as Judge Owens or not, they do, because they're generally traveling and don't want to be shipping all these boxes of materials everywhere, although some of them still do, that you're traveling with iPads, reading the briefs on the iPads. So they're going to have them. How they further use them is, you know, a personal choice.
Yeah, we are seeing more and more judges come to the bench with an iPad and not the huge stacks of paper. There are still some, as MC says, that do use the stacks of paper, and they're often very organized. They have their own way of doing it. But when I started 7 years ago to now, we are seeing far more judges very comfortable with the iPads, because now if in private practice, if that's where you're coming from, all the lawyers have iPad or some version of a reader, everyone does. That was not the case when I made the transition in 2014. Some partners at Munger Tolles had iPads, but most didn't. I have to think now almost all of them have some sort of reader. And therefore, it's much easier. I never had an iPad until I became a judge, and so it took some time for me to understand how to use it. But if you've been using it for 10 years, you're certainly not going to come on the bench and not use it.
Well, as a practitioner, it's one of the more indispensable tools in my toolbox.
Yeah.
I use mine every day. And I was wondering, though, Judge, that's great to hear your perspective on this and how you have implemented the iPad into your experience in oral argument from the bench. Have you noticed an uptick in practitioners using the same sorts of technology when presenting argument to the court?
Yes, no doubt about it. They still bring the papers that they filed. I mean, you want to have copies of what you brought with you to court. But generally speaking, they relied much more on technology. Like when I first started, I remember very rarely would a lawyer bring a laptop computer into court. I mean, it would happen sometimes, but very rare. And then it wouldn't work. And, you know, all these things would happen. It was kind of a mess. That's not true anymore. You know, people are much more comfortable with it. And I also think people are, as judges, we're more accepting. I think in the past, if someone brought a computer in the courtroom, some judges might be thinking, well, you're not paying attention. What are you doing? Are you playing games? What are you doing with that thing? I think now judges understand it's much more part of the job. I mean, Judge Tallman on the Ninth Circuit, he brings his laptop on the bench and he types during argument. And so he has almost like a transcription of what the parties say, which is great when you're in conference because he has like almost a transcript of what was said. Wow. So I think once I saw judges doing those kinds of things, it became more acceptable for people to bring technology into the court.
I'll give a shout out to another friend of the show, Jeff Richardson, who writes the blog iPad JD. And Jeff uses an iPad. He practices in the Fifth Circuit like we do. Jeff maps out his oral argument on his iPad. I think he uses Good Notes, which is a companion app to Goodreader, and is very elaborate in how he does it. And MC, he draws all his diagrams and he knows where everything is spaced on the page, just like you were talking about. He sometimes will do it using sort of a hybrid approach where he will use a color printer in his office and print all that out and actually take that document to the lectern with him. But I think because you just don't ever know when your device is going to bite the bullet in a really inopportune time, I think it's really more of a fail safe for him, because I've heard him talk about recently using the device actually at the lectern. But this is the problem with 12.9 inches, in my view, really isn't big enough, especially as I get older and my eyes start to fail even more. But I have done it and it is a challenge, but you really do have to know your case to feel comfortable walking to the lectern with nothing but an iPad. It's been a little intimidating the times that I've done it, but I've carried it off. That you can still use paper, though, I think, judges. This is kind of coming around to that point. Even if you map it out in the way that Jeff does, you can still use paper and have it at the lectern with you. You don't have to strictly rely on technology during the argument.
If I were still an advocate, I would bring paper up to the bench. I would bring both. I'd have the iPad. Hopefully, I don't need to look at either one. But I would have the paper in front of me and I would have the iPad to the side. I mean, when I used to argue, what I would do is I would take two legal sized folders and I would attach them in the middle. So it's like a trifold. I would have, I think it was like case law on the left, record in the middle and on the right. And so I would take it into the courtroom. It'd be like one folder, but then you open it up and it was actually pretty big, right? It's three gigantic legal sized pages. And when I would argue cases, I almost never looked at it at all. It would be the times where they would say, well, what case says that? And if I slipped, I could say, well, on page 729 of this case, so I actually looked like I knew what I was talking about. But I would not, as an advocate, for the reasons you just said, Todd, I would not go up there and rely on an iPad with no notes in front of me, because all of a sudden you get a system update, you know, in the middle of argument, or sometimes you get, you know, some weird thing will happen where an iPad will start making a noise, or someone like does like find your phone or find your iPad. And all of a sudden, the iPad starts. So you got to turn it off. Yeah, you want to have paper there. But the nice thing about the iPad is it eliminates the need to necessarily maybe bring all of the excerpts of record on the bench with you. That looks clumsy, and you want to look a little smoother and slimmer than that when you go up there, more comp. So, but But I definitely think a combination of the two is the best way.
Todd, I'm glad you said about your eyesight, because I have to remind my colleagues and associates, if they're doing something for me for argument, I'm like, 16-point font, folks, okay? A little bit older eyes. I'm not going to be able to read that.
Mm-hmm. I still don't wear glasses. I turned 50 this year, so I still don't wear glasses. But I've noticed, like, reading fine print on, like, a bottle of Tylenol, like, how many pills do you, that stuff, I just can't read anymore. So I have to have my
hold it up.
Read that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to hold it too far. But then, because the print's so small, if you hold it too far, you still can't see it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I also like to do the same kind of thing. I like to have the key things, you know, available. So that if there's a particular case site or quote or something from the record to use, that it's there. So you're directly responsive to things. And then I always try to think about themes or the different ways questions could be asked or larger themes of questions. And I will pull out, I'm a big fan of charts. Like, I like to chart things out so that it's easily, you know, big font and charted out so that I can look down quickly, you know, for this point, these are the best citations or these are the best responses to this kind of question. And honestly, those charts, I've saved my bacon many times. Like, I've just happened to, a day or two before argument, figured out some angle that a judge might be interested in. And here's the answer to that, even if it wasn't directly put together that way in any of the briefs. And really just being able to flip to that chart when that question comes and go, yes, you know, right here, Your Honor, this is the key money point. And I have seen times where, oh, that really made a difference. Like, oh yeah, you know, that's in there. Okay. You know, I'm going to view this differently. So I think using that as a resource where you've already gone through and thought about all of those things and have it for the reasons that Judge Owens was saying, which is to have the answer for people.
That's really great. We were coming to the point, MC, where I was about to ask Judge Owens for a tip or a war story. And I'll give you an opportunity to present another one if you would like, but that's a great tip too. So Judge, our tradition on this podcast as we get ready to kind of wrap our conversation up is we like to have our guests offer a tip or a war story if they can share one. And since the theme of the day has been oral argument, if you had something in addition to the points that we've gone through so far today, we'd sure love to hear it from you.
I'll go back to what I said before. You've got to know your case and you have to understand what the judges are going through that week. I mean, look, I don't want to say boo-hoo-hoo for federal judges. We have a great job. Jobs as lawyers, where you're dealing with clients and deadlines and judges is honestly far harder than what we have to do. All we have to do is decide our case. I mean, think about that. If you think about it, as all we have to do as a judge, is we have to decide the cases in front of us. That's it. We don't have to worry about the lease on the building. We don't have to worry about, you know, how much are we going to pay these associates? We don't have to worry about any of that stuff. Is this client paying their bills? Is this client a slow pay? Are my partners going to allow me to bring this client in? Is it going to cause conflict with all these other cases we have? This would be great for me professionally, but may not be great for this technology company that the firm's represented for 10 years. I don't have any of those headaches. I don't have to worry about who's making partner. I don't have to do any of that. All I have to do is decide the case in front of me and go on to the next one. So in that way, I have the greatest job as a lawyer you can have, because all I really am doing is just looking at the law. I don't have to look at any of these others. But for advocates, just remember, that is what we're doing. And if we have to do it 30 times in a week or 25 times in a week, you have to understand that we're doing our best to be as prepared as we can in every single case. If you are less prepared than we are, that is a really bad sign. And the lawyers I've seen, the rare times I've lost my temper, and I've never really lost my temper, but the rare times where I've kind of, well, I didn't know he was like that, comments come out, is when lawyers are not prepared. So I'll give you an example. I'll flesh out the example I was talking about earlier. So we had a case where we had two major New York law firms involved, and you can imagine how much they're charging for this oral argument by the hour. And the guy was appealing a district court order. It was in a trademark case. And he made a comment about what the district court did. And that's when I said, well, where did the district court say that? Where is it in the order? I'm not finding it. And he literally said, well, I don't have the order in front of me. And that to me was so shocking, because how much is your client paying for this appeal? How much are they paying you for this? The whole appeal is about this order. and you don't have it in front of you. And he ended up losing. Now, I'm not saying that's the reason why he lost, but that didn't help. And that story has happened enough times, just makes me really wonder, what are some of these lawyers doing? Because we're doing our best and we're on case 27 to 30. And for you to not even have the order in front of you that you're appealing, come on. So I think that's the main thing, is that as an advocate, what we want is we want someone who answers the questions straight that we ask. And the vibe we want is someone that's almost like we're in a huddle and they're helping us figure out the answer, right? Mm-hmm. Now, they're an advocate, they're not a judge, but if the vibe they get is, here, look, I'm here to help you guys. This is a hard case. I acknowledge it's a hard case, but there is an answer, and I'm going to help you guys get there. If that's the vibe we get, that's an advocate that's really helped us. The advocate that's tap dancing up there, not answering questions, doesn't have the record in front of them, bad, bad, bad. And so it's really no secret. It's the axioms I'm sure you've heard again and again and again, and they're true. They really are true, that the best prepared lawyer is the one who's going to be most comfortable being a helper to us. And if that's the attitude you can bring to the courtroom, wow, that really helps. You still may not win, right? Because you may have a terrible record below.
Yeah.
But boy, you're going to increase your chances as an advocate if you have that vibe, that comfort level. And that comfort level only comes through preparation. If you're not prepared, you're not going to have that level of confidence and comfort to really have that dialogue with the judges.
Oh, that's really great. I appreciate that perspective, Judge. Well, let's come at it from the advocate perspective one last time, MC. Did you have anything, any other tip that you would add to what the judge offered up?
Well, I really liked that last analogy to having that vibe of being sort of part of the team and helping decide the case and providing the information that's important to do so, obviously with a focus of advocating a particular mm-hmm. result for your client. But yeah, I think that's right. I think that's a really great way of putting what we always say about argument, that the best arguments are dialogues and conversations mm-hmm. and discussions of the issues and, you know, kind of where you need to go. And especially with the hard questions, being ready for those, because that's where the judges are going to have questions. You know, not sure what to do about this is the nub of the issue in this case. And how do we deal with that?
Well, you've both been, it's been so great to visit with you,
start off.
And we've gone a little longer than we usually do today, but the conversation has been great. I think very informative.
Fantastic.
So thank you, Judge Owens, for being with us,
sure.
for you know, reaching out beyond California over here into Texas, and sharing your experience with us. And MC, thank you so much for suggesting that we talk with Judge Owens, and also mm-hmm. for participating in the conversation with us. You know, you're a good friend of the show, and you're welcome back anytime. So
absolutely.
With that,
much. It was a lot of fun today.
It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It really was. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.